Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Excuse me, Stephanie's dad called out as he saw her heading for the front door. Where do you think you're going in that outfit? Oh, Daddy, she sighed. I'm just going over to Susie's, no big deal. I'm sorry, a bare middle and pants that don't begin until halfway down your rear are not acceptable anywhere. And who is going to be at Susie's? 15-year-old Stephanie began to roll her eyes. Only Fred and Darren. We're just going to hang out. What's the big deal? The big deal is which of Stephanie's parents will be home while you four are hanging out. You know the rules, young lady. Dad, I am 15 now. Why do I have to have all these rules? Don't you trust me? From a parent's perspective, how can we best help our adolescents deal with the sexual issues so prevalent in the teen years? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is an expert on this subject and has navigated this tricky period with her own teenagers, now grown men. Deborah Rothman is a full-time sexuality educator in independent schools, grades 4 through 12 in the Baltimore, Washington area, involved in teacher training and parenting education. Deborah's book, Sex and Sensibility, is a helpful resource for families. Her next book, But How'd I Get In There in the First Place, is for parents who are talking with their young children. She has two sons, one a resident in neuropsychiatry and the other a senior in college. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Debbie.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
What's the most important point for parents of teens to remember about sexual awareness in the teen years?
First of all, let's remind parents that there's no magic bullet here. Everybody's at least a little bit uncomfortable with this subject, at least to a degree. And to be kind to yourself and to say this is a hard subject and don't expect to be able to deal with it necessarily all by yourself without getting some input and guidance from your own peers as parents and from professionals if this is a subject that stymies you, because it really can be mastered. That's my message to parents, is that this is a subject that they can handle if they will learn to apply what they know about other parenting issues to this subject. They'll do quite well.
Don't run the other way.
Don't run the other way. You can't ignore it, because then we get into all kinds of problems. But know that it's going to be probably somewhat daunting, but that you can do it.
There's a wonderful poster that I've seen on bus stops now, and it has a picture of two teenagers looking very wholesome and refreshing. And it says, talk to your teens about sex. Everyone else is.
You bet. Oh, great. You bet. As I was listening to you, Sandy, give your wonderful introduction about that lovely vignette, I was thinking about a recent commercial on television, which actually was withdrawn after about a week of protest. It was a department store ad. It was a back-to-school ad. And there was a teenage girl primping in front of the mirror for her first day of school. And she was dressed just about as you described before, only this girl was not going off to a party. This girl was going off to school. And her mother came in, took one look at her, and said, "You are not going to school like that." And then she walked over to her and pulled her pants down even further and said, "Now you're ready."
Oh, dear.
So when you say everybody else wants to talk to your child about sex and tell them how to handle sex in their life, you're absolutely right. It's no accident, actually, that the media is so obsessed with sex. It's because they know there's a vacuum out there for people, and particularly for kids. And although nature is said to abhor a vacuum, the media adore it. And they've jumped right into it, both feet. And they know that our children have big bucks. And it's almost like a Pied Piper effect. And I find parents very, very frightened these days. They're people after their children's attitudes and values and money.
Well, with that as a background, what's the most common mistake we make when dealing with sexual issues with our teens?
I think, and this is really one of the central messages of my book, we tend to think about sex in a very narrow way, that sex equals intercourse. And the first thing we have to remind ourselves is that sexual behavior exists along a continuum. And we need to be giving our children messages about the kinds of values that should be in place when they're in the seventh grade and they kiss somebody for the first time. Not just maybe when they're older and they might be involved in an intercourse situation. There's a range of sexual behaviors that kids at different ages and stages of development are involved in, and they need guidance along that whole spectrum. So we need to look at the way we define and think about the word sex, and we also need to think about the way we define the word sexuality. We need to not be so concerned about, or just concerned about, their behavior. We need to be concerned about their growth and development as sexual and gendered people along lots of dimensions. So we need to be looking at not only giving information, but limit setting, as that story, again, that you told before, Sandy, really hones in on. We need to be providing them with anticipatory guidance for situations that they're going to find themselves in. We need to be talking endlessly about values. And we need to be affirming that they are developing sexual people every step of the way. So it's a bigger job than we think it is.
So we have to really think a couple of steps ahead of our teens, which is a tall order.
And step back and see the big picture.
It's hard to get them to listen. You can't really lecture.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trick. When your children get older, you have to learn different ways of communicating with them. And one of the things that's frightening about it is that we have a sense that we're losing our power, which we are. But we can still maintain influence because our children really do want to be close to us and they want our input, even though they often make it look as if they don't. Who was it who wrote that wonderful book, Talk to Your Children in Ways That They Will Listen and Listen in the Ways That They Will Talk? That's really where it's at. We've got to learn a different way of listening and talking to our kids and sharing our values.
You've talked with a lot of adolescents, as we know. What do you think they want their parents to know?
One of the things that's really important for adolescents as they become separate individuals is they have to be able to separate in terms of their attitudes and values and beliefs about important issues, which means they have to push and pull against their parents' values, which means it's really helpful to know what they are. And when parents are not clear about what they think and value, and I find this still to be the case for most kids, they're not real sure about where their parents are. They can't push and pull as effectively. And kids instinctively know this. And I think what they really want is for their parents to talk to them, to share with them in ways that we were talking about before, where it's not a lecture, where it's, you know, I've given a lot of thought to this, and here's what I really think and value. What do you think about that? And to have that give and take is what kids need and want. More than anything, they want to know where their parents stand, and they also don't want to disappoint their parents. And if they're not clear what their parents' values are, it's hard for them to know how to please them.
One of the problems that I think always comes up with parents is when they try to have the talk. Okay. And assuming they're not running out of the room,
right.
Do you have any suggestions?
Well, when you say the talk, Sandy, do you mean little children, adolescents? Because the talk, of course, if you mean about the birds and the bees and the basics of sexual reproduction, et cetera, is really age appropriate at even younger ages, in fact, much younger ages. But there are parents who feel, okay, I know we've covered the basics, but my child is now in high school, so I better sit down and have that talk with them about protecting yourself and all of that. And there's an awful lot of anxiety attached to looking at it that way. You know, you've got one chance and you've got to make sure it's the right time and you say it exactly the right way. That's an enormous amount of pressure. It's uncomfortable for the parent, and the child is likely to have one question only, which is, can I leave now when it's all over? It's so important for parents to learn how to have an ongoing dialogue. And you know, the good news about sex being everywhere in the media is that it's everywhere. And that means that there are endless teachable moments for parents to capitalize on. That advertisement I described before would be a great opportunity to say, what do you think about that? And here are all the ways that it bothered me from a parent's perspective. How'd you see it from a kid's perspective? What do you think about the way kids dress when they go to school? What messages are they giving? How might these messages be misinterpreted by other people? And that's really the crux of it. I always tell parents, it's not so much the content of what you talk about. It's that you talk about it, that it's a subject for conversation, and that their children know that you're there to listen as well as to give your thoughts.
I think also we need to be reassured that even though the kids are sometimes very uncomfortable with some of the things we're talking with them about, they're very grateful that we've brought up
the
subject.
You bet. And I learned this as a first-year teacher, thinking that I was just terrible, just awful. And then I'd walk down the hallway, and you know, these kids who'd been sitting in my room staring at me like I had three heads were like quoting me to other people. They have a vested interest in making it look like they don't need us. Mm-hmm. And we have to not be fooled by that.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of teens and sex.
two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Deborah Rothman about teens and sexuality.
How about those teens who are really off to the races with their early social interactions? What's the best way to try to help them keep their urges under some degree of control?
Well, I think the urges part is something, again, that we overemphasize as adults. You know, we tend to talk about teenagers and their raging hormones, and I wish we could sort of strike that phrase because it makes it sound as if kids can't control their behavior. And why would we, you know, even want to imply that? There's certainly an increased sex drive, and we have to be prepared to help our children be prepared for that. But they're really responding more to gender messages that they're getting and social messages that they're getting and cultural messages, popular cultural messages that they're getting, than biological urges. At least that's what I think. They have a great need to belong, which we all do, but which is to belong and feel accepted and acceptable and attractive is crucially important at this age. It's the first time that they're really stepping into those waters. And they're driven, I think, much more by that need than any other. So that we have to help them temper that need, understand that that's really important, but that the simplistic ways that they're being shown that sex will get them where they want to go in terms of popularity and affection and relationships really is a lie, and that they've got to be thinking deeper than that.
That's interesting because I guess we all remember when ads for cars were exclusively sex and acceptance
glamour.
And glamour and,
mm-hmm. And now everything's
even alcohol.
Actually. Everything's that way.
Yeah, that's right.
And alcohol is still that way. And I mean, the number one cofactor for unprotected sexual intercourse and for date or acquaintance rape among high school and college students is alcohol or other drug use. Mm. So when they're constantly seeing ads that depict sexual situations where alcohol is essential, that those two things go together wonderfully, that's extraordinarily dangerous for our kids. So until we do something about that connection, I think we're not going to really do a whole lot about their effective sexual decision-making.
But it's another whole area we have to make sure we open up.
You bet.
How can parents best establish guidelines for sexual behavior, since we're talking about this, how we feel about it and so on? And do you think that the teenagers should be involved in this?
Well, I think absolutely. And that's part of what we were mentioning before when we were saying that you really have to shift the way you talk and the way you treat kids as they become adolescents. They are driven to think on their own, just like toddlers are driven to toddle around and don't like it when you try and constrain them. Teenagers don't like it when you tell them what they're supposed to think because that's contrary to their developmental messages that they're giving themselves. They've got to learn how to think on their own. So they have to be involved in the conversation. But I think the problem is we don't have the right kind of language to have those conversations. Again, what I was saying earlier was that sex equals intercourse. Well, what about all those that other behavior, from kissing and hand-holding and various kinds of touching and caressing that teenagers are involved in? We have to help them redefine sex as a continuum of behaviors, starting with minimally physically intimate behaviors like hand-holding and kissing, which can be very emotionally intimate but still are not physically terribly intimate, all the way down the other end of the spectrum to behaviors which are very, very intimate, involving behaviors like intercourse, and help them understand that there are certain values that ought to be in place along the way, and that the way you learn to set limits for yourself is by seeing if those values are in place. And if they're not, you want to question, why am I becoming physically involved with the person where these other aspects of the relationship are not there or not there yet? And the six values that I hear parents come back to over and over and over again, these are really the ones they want their children to think about, are the following. They want them to understand that all sexual behavior, kissing, hand-holding, touching, whatever it is, should be in the context of caring. Not saying that two eighth graders who share their first kiss are in love with one another. They may like each other a lot, but the real issue is caring. This is a level of commitment that you can have even at that stage of interaction. I'm committed, not going to marry you exactly, but I'm committed to caring for and about you. And I don't involve myself in intimate physical contact with others, even on this level, unless there are feelings of closeness and caring. They want their kids to think that sexual behavior is meaningful, that it's not recreation, that it's not like bowling, you know, that it's deeper than that, that it has some meaning in the cosmos, and that it should be treated carefully and with thought and forethought.
It's interesting because there's so many programs, even on primetime television, mm-hmm. that treat sexual relationships as recreational.
You bet. And even if it's not showing skin so that people aren't screaming about it, that message is definitely there. And I actually worry a lot more about the quote-unquote more subtle kinds of situations where it's just implied that these people have just met mm-hmm. and off they go. Mm-hmm. And that maybe they've just met in a bar and off they go. So we're headed toward a society where sex is going to be defined as recreation, unless those of us who think that that's not the case know how to articulate that to our children. Third, they want children to understand that it should be responsible. And again, we have to be careful. Usually we talk about responsibility in terms of disease and pregnancy. Uh-uh. There's all kinds of responsibility. There are all kinds of ethical and important issues to consider, not just about physical consequences. They want their children to understand that this is private behavior, which flies in the face of cultural values, that it should be gradual, that this is a gradual unfolding of yourself to another person. Just like you don't start learning to drive on the beltway, you don't start your sexual experiences with deep, intimate sharing. And the other, of course, is they want it to be mutual and freely chosen in the absence of pressure. And I think those are wonderful guidelines. Parents often, I would say, need help in articulating those values. They know them in their heart, but they don't know exactly how to share them with their children. And they don't, frankly, know quite how important they are. They're incredibly important. We take those values for granted in a way. But unless we help kids apply them to sexual situations, they're not going to know how to do that.
How can we help our teens deal with the peer pressure they often face to succumb to inappropriate sexual behavior? The peers are a big problem.
I think the peer pressure becomes important when other things are absent. I think when kids walk into a situation where they haven't been prepared by the immediate adults in their lives, meaning teachers, parents, clergy, to think through the meaning of sex, they get into a situation where somebody says, well, why not? And they don't know the answer because they don't know what the real purpose and meaning is supposed to be about. Well, if it's recreation, well, and we're here having a good time, you know, what? Why not? But if it's something different than that, and they have to really be helped to see that, as I say, they're not going to see it on their own, then they know what they stand for, and they can find a voice if they've had these opportunities to talk about it. Otherwise, they're not going to find their voice.
Is it helpful for teens these days to say no because we now have the business of sexually transmitted diseases arising again?
That's a double-sided situation, I'm afraid. We've done a very lousy job of educating people about sexually transmitted diseases. We've overemphasized HIV, if that's possible. But we've sorely, in the process, under-educated people about other kinds of sexually transmitted infections that statistically teenagers are much more likely to run into. So the fact that STDs are out there, it gives them something to think about, but unless we help them to think about it in the right way, it's going to backfire, for example. Because people misunderstand these other infections, they try to apply what they know about HIV to those infections, and that's not real helpful because some of the information applies and some of it doesn't. But the other is, we've spent like 20 years now saying to kids, don't have sex, don't have sex, don't have sex. But if we haven't stopped to define exactly what we mean by that, don't have sex because you could get a disease, right? If we haven't said, okay, and here's what I mean by sex. There are many forms of sex. Here are the kinds that can lead to those infections. Then we haven't done our job.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of teens and sex.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Deborah Rothman, author of Sex and Sensibility, The Thinking Parent's Guide to Talking Sense About Sex.
There are middle school kids who act as if they think oral sex is low-risk behavior, that they're being responsible because they're not having intercourse, because they don't define oral sex as sex. Therefore, we've said, you get this from sex. They don't think this is sex, so they think it's safe. And again, it has to do with our reluctance to be as specific and explicit as we need to be. There are many, many schools, I would dare say most schools, can't deal with the explicitness that we really need to deal with kids in elementary and even in middle school. Many do in high school, but it's way too late. Kids have all kinds of misconceptions by then that they have to unlearn, and that's really hard.
What do you mean they can't deal with the explicitness?
It's forbidden. They can't deal with the kind of detail that you have to go into, for example, to explain female-to-male transmission of HIV. Means that you have to talk about sexual response, you have to talk about vaginal lubrication, for example, very specific things about how bodies work. And that, quite frankly, is not going to be permitted in the curriculum in most schools, I would say, in this country, in elementary and middle schools. And we have increasingly, we have one-third of our high schools now, and I don't know what it is in terms of middle school, probably equivalent, where abstinence only is the only education that can be provided so that you can talk somewhat about the spread of infection, but you can't talk about prevention. You can't talk about condoms, for example, unless it is to emphasize that they don't always work.
Oh, boy. So that means that it's even an increased burden on parents.
Exactly.
And on
very, very
religious
good
communities
point.
And other adults who are involved in other activities to try to help with this.
Right. And the kids are at school. That's where the captive audience is. So if you try and do it subgroup by subgroup, it's an impossible job. And we're going backwards. I mean, increasingly, schools are adopting abstinence-only programs because it makes adults feel good, that they're, you know, giving a hard line. It makes politicians look good because they look like they're, you know, waving the flag of morality. And meanwhile, we're leaving our kids out in the cold.
What are the statistics in situations where kids are only given abstinence as their sex education?
Well, I can tell you that 3 million teenagers, we're sitting right here, right now, 3 million teenagers in this country have a sexually transmitted infection.
3 million?
3 million. 50% of teenagers by the age of 17, I think it is now, have had sexual intercourse. So that the abstinence message, which is a very, very important one, but also has to be delivered in ways that can be heard developmentally by kids, and that's not always the case, that message does not apply to lots of our kids at this point in time. Even if we could all figure out how to give fabulous abstinence messages tomorrow, there would still be hundreds of thousands, in fact, millions of kids at risk. And as an educator, I feel a responsibility, a moral responsibility, of course, to provide life-saving information. If I know it, I'm going to share it. And teachers have their hands tied across the country, and increasingly so.
It sounds like there needs to be a groundswell of pressure from teachers.
Parents cannot be the lone voice. Kids need to hear the same kinds of messages reinforced over and over by the immediate adults in their lives who really care about them, not people who are after their money and their attention.
We saw really interesting lists of questions in your book mm-hmm. as we had the opportunity to read it. Would you tell us a little bit more about your book, Sex and Sensibility, The Thinking Parent's Guide to Talking Sense About Sex?
It has two parts. The first half is really about helping us think outside the box that we've been thinking in for a very long time, a very small box about this subject. After all, teenagers, let's say 150 years ago, the average age of puberty for a girl was around 16. That's when she got married. Very handy. Mm-hmm. Today, girls get their period on average at about 12, 12 and a half. The average age of marriage is 25 for girls. So we've spent the last 150 years creating this period called adolescence, and prolonged, very prolonged adolescence, yet we're still working out of the same paradigms in terms of how we're talking, what we think will work with them in terms of sex education. We've got to realize that this is a vastly different world. We have to raise our children in the world that they live in, not the world we would like it to be. And the second part is, okay, once we've got those realizations and some new ways of looking at the issue of sex and sexuality and values, what are the needs that our children have, specific needs that our children have, and how can we notice them and best meet them? And I mentioned these earlier, too. Our children have, from birth on, have the need to be affirmed as developing sexual and gendered people. They have the need for information in an ongoing way. They have the need for discussion about values constantly in very specific and ongoing and as they get older, dynamic ways. They have a clear need for limit setting, which is another place that I would say parents have done a less good job with in this last 10, 20 years. Parents are working too hard, I think, often to be their children's friends rather than, and it's great. I mean, I think parents have a wonderful relationship with kids today that I certainly don't think I had with my parents. We really are friends. But they've got to be able to put their foot down and set limits. And the last one is the need for guidance. We have to be, as you said, one step ahead of our children at least. And if we don't know where they are, which we by and large don't, look at the furor that this issue of oral sex in middle school created. I mean, it wasn't on anybody's radar screen. So if we're out of touch with where our children are, how can we expect that we're going to be able to help them deal with the next step that's coming down the pike?
Are there other resources besides Sex and Sensibility that you'd recommend for parents about teens and sexual issues?
Our children are receiving as many destructive messages about gender as they are about sex. And I always, always recommend that they read and reread the classic Reviving Ophelia by Mary Pfeiffer, which really nails where this culture is in terms of unhealthy messages we're constantly giving girls about gender. And my other two favorite books about boys, are Raising Cain by Michael Thompson and Don Kinlan, and Real Boys by William Pollack.
There's an awful lot of reading there what parents need to do to catch up.
You bet.
And I guess the other thing is talking to other parents so that we can reaffirm our reality checks and our intentions to do what is going to be hard, but what we need to do.
Yeah, I think parents have to talk to other parents for at least three reasons. One, it helps them get clear on their values. Two, it helps them get clear on what's developmentally appropriate. Because when you're setting limits, you want to make sure they're not too close together or too far apart. I mean, you want to put limits around your children that give them room to breathe and make some mistakes, but aren't so wide that they're too big for them to handle. And you can only really do that by working it through with other parents of kids your own children's age, but also parents who've been through this with older children. And the third thing is parents must form associations, whether it's grade level meetings or small groups of parents of kids who are friends. If you don't have communication with other parents, you cannot do it. It's just too huge to deal with the tide of adolescent and the tide of culture and the tide of peer group influence by yourself is, I think, today impossible. I think starting at about grade four, we have to start making sure our children know, you know, there will be limits. I am a limit setter in your life, and we will negotiate those limits as you get older. But I am a limit setter. I see way too many kids who think that they are free agents by the time they're 14 years old, that their social life, they're in charge.
Apparently,
end of discussion.
It's a big security measure for kids to know that there is a limit setter in their lives.
Even if they complain.
They know they need it.
Well, it's more comforting for them to find out that somebody is in charge of that piece because they don't want to be in charge of that. It's too scary.
And they feel loved when people care enough about them to set limits.
That's right. That's an important lesson, I think.
Yes. Well, we are certainly grateful to Deborah Rothman for joining us today to cover a lot of these important issues. Thank you so much for being
with us. My pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our second book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning in from. Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about us and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.